One of my responsibilities at work, and this is probably going to turn you off me instantly, is that I set exam questions. And you think, oh no, he's one of those nasty types. True. And tonight, I'm going to set you an exam question. The question is this. Can you summarise the Bible in one sentence? Now I know you're going to say, well, I'm sure you're going to say more than one sentence tonight, and you're right. But where would you begin? If you were asked to summarise the message of the Bible, where would you start? Well, for some, they would say, well, the Bible, it's a handbook of morality. It's kind of a book that tells us, a textbook, if you like, as to how we should live. And you would probably turn to the Sermon on the Mount and say, well, there you are. There's some instructions as to how we should live our lives. But maybe your knowledge of the Bible is a bit deeper than that. And you say, well, no, the Bible is about Jesus. First and foremost, it's about him. And the example that he gives to us of integrity. Jesus is the classic example of integrity. Take, for example, his trial. He demonstrates such consummate integrity. But maybe you say, no, I don't feel that really captivates the Bible. It doesn't capture the whole thing. The Bible is about the love of God. It's about how God displays his love and the great sacrificial nature of the love of God. And you would turn to Corinthians and say, well, there you are. There's a great description of love. And truly, surely, that has been shown by God himself. Well, if we can be so impertinent, how would the apostles have answered such an exam question? Where would they have started? Well, I don't think the Apostle Paul would have had any hesitation as to where he would have started. He would have started in Romans chapter 1, verse 16. For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. The Bible is about the gospel. It's about the good news. The good news of salvation for the believing. It's about a righteousness, a perfection, a holiness that comes down from God upon those who believe. And this gospel, this message, this good news is for all types. It's for Jew and for Gentile. And the Apostle Paul is insistent upon that very point. It's for all. It's for Jew and Gentile. He says that there in verse 16. He says it again in the next chapter, that judgment will come on the Jew first and also on the Gentile. And then again in verse 10, the Jew first and also the Gentile. You see, it doesn't matter who you are and what your background is, the gospel, the good news, the message of the Bible is for you. Now the Apostle Paul goes about establishing this fact that we all stand in need of the good news. We all stand in need of this salvation. And he reaches a climax in his argument in chapter 3, where he says this, establishing this universal need. What then? Are we better than they? No, in no wise, for we have before proved, both Jews and Gentiles, there it is again, that they are all under sin. As it is written, there is none righteous, no, not one. There is none that understandeth. understand it, there is none that seeketh after God. They are all gone out of the way. They are together become unprofitable. There is none that doeth good. No, not one. So he reaches this point of establishing this universal need that we are all unrighteous, that we are all guilty before God. Now you might ask the question, well, how does he arrive at that conclusion? How does he reach that point? Well, first of all, he begins in chapter 1 by looking at the Gentiles. Now, in a sense, the Gentile world was an easy place to start. It was obvious from any assessment of the Gentile world in Paul's day that they had sunk very low. The evils that were expressed in the Gentile world were disgraceful. And Paul begins to discuss how it is that the Gentile world has sunk into this position. You see, he says that they have a knowledge of God, a knowledge that comes from the created world. And they should have interpreted that knowledge to seek God. But instead of that, they suppress that knowledge. And instead of worshipping the Creator, they turned to worshipping things that had been created. And they turned the glory of God, this wonderful, eternal, everlasting being, they turned him into an image of a man or a cow or a fish. And they worshipped idols, images. They worshipped nature itself. And the consequence of that for the Gentile world was that they became obsessed with sex. God gave them up to lust and to an explosion of sexual immorality. And the consequence of that was that God gave them up again, only this time to an explosion of homosexuality. And they began to sink lower and lower until Paul sums it up by using this phrase, that they had a reprobate mind, a mind devoid of understanding, a mind unable to discern between right and wrong. The Gentile world became one in which good was called bad and bad was called good. It was all mixed up. A world of wickedness, a world of sin. But not only that. It wasn't just that this was their society. But in fact, they reveled in it. It wasn't just that they did these things, but they took great pleasure in it. They took pleasure in committing these sins and pleasure in observing other people committing these sins. This was the Gentile world of Paul's day. Now, it's not rocket science, is it? But you only have to read your newspaper or watch your television or listen to the radio and you realise that the world of Paul's day is very similar to the world of our day. What Paul describes here has an uncanny similarity to 21st century Britain. We are living in the Gentile world. Now, when you read of such things, when you hear on the news of another murder, another stabbing, another shooting, another armed robbery, well, what do you think? How do you react? Well, surely you say, well, it's appalling. You know, it's almost reached a stage where I'm ashamed to be British. Maybe that's how you respond. Well, Paul introduces something new in verse 31, verse 32 of chapter 1. He introduces this concept of the judgment of God. who knowing the judgment of God, that they which commit such things are worthy of death, not only do the same, but have pleasure in them that do them. And Paul is now introducing this idea, this concept, that God is going to bring men and women to judgment. Ultimately, there will be justice. Now, how do you respond to that? You look out at the wicked world and you say, judgment? Amen. Hear, hear, bring it on. Not before time. Oh, if only God would judge sinners. If only God would end this wickedness. Let's have judgment now. Why does God delay? Why is he so slow in bringing men to judgment? Well, my friend, if that is how you respond to the wicked world and to the idea of judgment, then tonight's message is for you. Paul has three things to say about the judgment of God. And the first of them is this, that when it comes to the judgment of God, there are no excuses. There are no excuses. We need to dive into Paul's argument now in a bit more detail. In chapter 2, he begins like this. Therefore, thou art inexcusable, O man, whosoever thou art that judgest, for wherein thou judgest another, thou condemnest thyself. For thou that judgest, doest the same things. Paul is now turning his attention away from the Gentile world and towards the Jewish world. And up until this point, his Jewish readers would have heartily agreed with him. They would have heartily agreed with this, his assessment of the Gentile world, and they would have heartily agreed with the prospect. Indeed, they would have had a sense of satisfaction that God was going to bring the Gentile world into judgment. God would judge them for their wickedness. But Paul says, hold on, wait a minute. You have to understand that when it comes to the judgment of God, there are no excuses. You have to understand that. You see, when it comes to the judgment of God, when it comes to God bringing justice, there's a problem. And the problem is this, that if we pass judgment on somebody else, that same judgment will be applied to us. You see, in a sense, there's nothing wrong with condemning sin. We should condemn sin. But the problem comes when we condemn sin in other people and we are not condemning the same sin in ourselves. You see, it's no good doing that. As soon as we condemn sin, if we are guilty of the same thing, we are condemning ourselves. We have to understand that that is how the judgment of God works. Now, this was particularly pertinent to the Jewish people, because this was a very prevalent attitude among them. They looked down on the Gentiles. After all, hadn't God chosen them? The Jews? No, the Gentiles, they were God's rejects. God didn't want them. They were ignorant people. They were morally inferior. They were just dogs. God wasn't interested in them. They were just fit for judgment. They were cannon fodder. But us? Oh no, we're special, you know, for God. Jesus has to deal with this very problem. And he does so in his Sermon on the Mount. Judge not, he says, judge not, that ye be not judged. For with what judgment ye judge, ye shall be judged. And with what measure ye meet, it shall be measured to you again. And then comes one of his most humorous illustrations. And why beholdest thou the mote, the speck, that is in thy brother's eye, but considerest not the beam, the plank, that's in thine own eye? How wilt thou say to thy brother, let me pull out the mote out of thine own eye, out of thine eye, and behold, a beam is in thine own eye? Thou hypocrite, first cast out the beam out of thine own eye, and then shalt thou see clearly to cast the mote out of thy brother's eye. It's no good. Your brother comes to you and says, I've got a bit of dust in my eye. Can you help me get it out? He says, yeah, no problem at all. And you've got a big log sticking out of your own eye. It's not going to work, is it? It is very humorous. But the point is this. Jesus is saying, use the same standard of judgment on yourself as you use on other people. Don't be a hypocrite, says Jesus. You see, in all their clamour for judgment, there was a great deal of hypocrisy among the Jews. It may be Jesus' other most humorous comment. He says something which is on the same lines. He's speaking about the religious leaders of his day, and he says this, ye blind guides, which strain at a gnat and swallow a camel. What's he saying? Oh, look, a little fly has fallen into my cup of tea. I'd better strain it out. And you strain out the little gnat, but what you can't see is that there's a camel standing in the cup, and you drink it. You're a hypocrite, he says. You can see the little things, but you can't see the big things. Don't be hypocrites. Now, of course, the most powerful example of this is the example that we read in 2 Samuel chapter 12. The prophet Nathan comes to the godly king David, and he tells him this pathetic story of a man with his little ewe lamb who is brought up in his house as his daughter. His neighbour is loaded. He has flocks and herds, no problem. A visitor comes to the neighbour. He says, oh no, I'm not going to kill one of my sheep. And so he goes next door and he snatches the sheep off the poor man next door and kills it for lunch. And David is incensed. He is livid. The man that has done this thing shall surely die. He shall repay fourfold for what he's done. And Nathan says, thou art the man. It's you. Me? Yes, it's you. God says, I gave you the nation of Israel. I gave you Israel and Judah. I gave you lots of wives. And now you've stolen another man's wife and slept with her. And now, in order to cover your tracks, you've had him killed. Now notice, David hadn't lost his sense of moral integrity. He hadn't lost his sense of judgment. He was well able to see that stealing the lamb was wrong. But he was totally blind to the worst sin that he himself had committed. Now listen, my friends. This was a problem prevalent among the Jews. But if we stand here and say, oh, those Jews, you know, what a bunch of hypocrites they are. We are guilty of the same thing. It's no good applying judgment of hypocrisy on Jews and not applying it to ourselves. How does Paul apply this? Well, if you look later on in chapter 2, he applies it in this way. Verse 21. Thou therefore which teachest another, teachest thou not thyself? Here we are, the same thing. You're speaking to somebody else, you're speaking to yourself. Thou that preachest a man should not steal, dost thou steal? Now you probably saw on the news and read in your newspapers about the ship Napoli that's grounded on the coast in Dorset. And the beachcombers are down there en masse, they're rounding up motorbikes or whatever it is they could grab off this boat. And we sit there thinking, oh, isn't that terrible? Isn't that shocking? Oh, how low we've sunk. Listen, my friend, are there things in your home that don't belong to you? Things that you've acquired by, shall we say, somewhat less than straightforward means. Thou that preachest, a man should not steal. Dost thou steal? Thou that sayest a man should not commit adultery. Dost thou commit adultery? You say, I've never committed adultery. Why do you read those lurid accounts of people's immorality in the newspaper? Why do you watch such graphic portrayals of immorality on your televisions? Is it not to excite your own lusts? What else does Paul say? Thou that abhorrest idols, dost thou commit sacrilege? I've never bowed down to an idol. I haven't even got a crucifix in my home. No. But if your back was up against the wall, there are some things that you'd rather keep hold of and part company with God. We must be careful that we don't apply different standards to ourselves than the standards we apply to other people. We must remember this, that when it comes to the judgment of God, there are no excuses. God won't listen to them. There are no excuses. But the second thing about the judgment of God is this. There are no exceptions. There are no exceptions. The Apostle Paul was a Jew. In fact, in one place he even describes himself as a Hebrew of the Hebrews. He was a quintessential Jew. And he knew exactly how his countrymen would respond to being confronted with this truth. He knew that they would say, that doesn't actually apply to us. You see, we're unique. I know you've probably forgotten it, Paul, but we have a special relationship with God. We're in our own little category, you know. Because God chose our fathers and their descendants, and we're a privileged people. And that means that God isn't going to treat us in the way that he's going to treat them. They are going to get the full weight of God's justice. But us, well, we're a special case. And God's going to be a bit lenient to us. He'll make an exception for us. Now, Paul knows that that's how they will respond. So what does he say? Verse 2, but we are sure that the judgment of God is according to truth against them which commit such things. What's he saying? Firstly, God's judgment is according to truth. It's according to the facts of the case. God's judgment, his view, is not distorted by any perceived special relationship. God's character is not going to be tainted or tarnished by any miscarriage of justice. There will be no perversion of justice when it comes to the judgment of God. Now, Paul is at pains to point this out. He says it again and again in this passage, verse 6, who will render to every man according to his deeds. Verse 11, for there is no respect of persons with God. God isn't going to have one rule for one and another rule for another. What he applies to one, he will apply to the other. There are no exceptions when it comes to the judgment of God. There is no partiality, there is no favoritism. God will judge fairly and impartially across the board. As he says in another place, by no means and under no circumstances will he clear the guilty. God is not in the business of clearing the guilty. Now notice too what he says. We are sure that the judgment of God is according to truth. He's saying, look, we know this of a certain. We're absolutely sure about this. This is an incontestable fact. This is something of which we are innately aware. That when God judges one person for stealing, he will judge another person in exactly the same way for exactly the same thing. There are no exceptions when it comes to the judgment of God. Now listen, my friend. How did you respond when you heard Paul say that there are no excuses? You said in your heart, ah, yes, of course, but I'm a special case, you know. We're all special cases in our hearts. Listen, my friends, there are no exceptions. But you say, look, we live in Britain. We're a special case. Yeah, we can see how God would judge heathen nations, people who live in such barbarous conditions. We can understand God's judging them. But us? There are no exceptions. I say, yeah, but we're Welsh. We can understand that God will judge the English. I mean, they've oppressed us for centuries. But we're Welsh, you know. We have a special relationship with God. There are no exceptions. Ah, but you say, yes, but we're South Wales. We can understand up in North Wales, they're a bit strange up there. We can understand that God might judge them, but us? Oh, no, we really are quite different down here. There are no exceptions. But you say, look, we're Newport. We can understand how God might judge the wicked people of Cardiff. He might judge those evil people in Cumbran. But Newport? Oh, no. No, we're special. There are no exceptions. How about you say, look, we're Chapel. We're Emmanuel. Some of us have been coming here for years. Some of us have been coming here for generations. You know, we come Sunday after Sunday. We sing the hymns. We read the Bible. We hear the messages. Some of us have even taught in Sunday school. And we come to additional meetings if there's food available. There are no exceptions. None whatsoever. When God judges the sins that he finds in the mosque, he will judge the same sins in the same way that he finds at Emmanuel. When God judges the sins that he finds in the Alma Inn, he will judge the same sins in the same way that he finds at Emmanuel. There are no exceptions in the judgment of God. But you say, well, but hold on a minute. God knows my circumstances. He knows I was in a tight corner when I fiddled my tax return. He knows that I was up against the wall financially when I claimed a benefit I shouldn't have had. He does know. And there are no exceptions. You say, yeah, God knows that it was cheaper for me to go on holiday on a Sunday. Yes, he does know. And there are no exceptions. So, well, God knows that I wasn't finding my husband or my wife very attractive anymore when I had a fling. He does know. And there are no exceptions. Listen, my friend. Whatever your sin is, there will be no exception made for you. Understand it. There are no exceptions. So we need to see finally one thing, and that is this. There is no escape. There is no escape. Paul is aware how his readers will respond to his presentation of the judgment of God. And therefore he knows how they think. He knows what they're going to say. And therefore he comes with a rhetorical question which is going to cut off their argument. What does he say in verse 3? And thinkest thou this, O man, that judgest them which do such things, and doest the same, that thou shalt escape the judgment of God? Do you think you're going to escape, he says? Well, of course not. You see, the Jews were great escapologists. They had a history of escaping. They got into numerous tight fixes in their history, and things seemed impossible. You would have looked on and said, oh, they've had it now. They've had their chips, they're finished, they're done for. And somehow they managed to escape in the nick of time. Paul says, when it comes to the judgment of God, there is no escape. You won't find a way out. You won't be able to wheedle your way out and escape from the judgment of God. Maybe you think you can. Well, let's explore how you think you might escape the judgment of God. You say, well, I'll plead not guilty. After all, this doesn't really apply to me. I've never actually broken any of the commandments. No, I've never broken in and stolen from somebody's house. I've never slept with anyone's wife. I've never bowed down to an idol. Listen, my friend, Paul used to think like that himself. He used to think that it was all what he did that mattered. But then he read the last commandment. And the last commandment says, thou shalt not covet. And instantly he realized that it wasn't just what he did. Coveting isn't an outward act. Coveting is an inward thought, a desire. And he instantly saw that God's judgments were going to be on a different plane to anything he'd previously thought of. They were not going to be simply outward things, outward actions. God was going to bring him to judgment for inward things, for heart's desires, for the flowing of his mind. Jesus himself deals with this very thing in his Sermon on the Mount. He says, look, you've heard it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not. And he lists some of the commandments. He says, but I say to you, have you done it in your heart? Are you guilty of it in your mind? Listen, my friend. Outwardly, you might be a respectable person. You might be an upstanding member of the community. You might be whiter than white. But inwardly, you might be malicious, hateful, bitter, lustful, craving. There is no escape in the judgment of God by pleading not guilty. Because God knows better than that. Man looks on the outward appearance, but God looks on the heart. He's looking on the inside. My friend, don't even dream of pleading not guilty. There's no escape that way. But you say, well, I've got nothing for it. I'll give God the slip, and I'll run for it, and I shall hide from God. The Apostle John foresees those very people, and he describes them in Revelation. The stars of heaven fell to the earth, even as a fig tree casteth her untimely figs when she is shaken of a mighty wind. And the heaven departed as a scroll when it is rolled together, and every mountain and island were moved out of their place. He's describing the end of the world. And the kings of the earth, and the great men, and the rich men, and the chief captains, and the mighty men, and every bondman, and every free man, hid themselves in the dens and in the rocks of the mountains. And they said to the mountains and the rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him that sitteth on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of his wrath is come, and who is able to stand? John is saying, look, when it comes to the judgment of God, men will see it coming and they shall try to hide. They shall try to cheat the judgment of God by seeking death. But later on in his great vision of that which is to come, he says this, I saw a great white throne, and him that sat on it, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away, and there was found no room for them. And I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God, and the books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life, and the dead were judged out of those things which were written in the books according to their works. Listen, my friend, you cannot cheat the judgment of God by death. There is no escape that way. Maybe you've never thought of it like this, but the Apostle John has seen you. Yes, you. He has seen you. Where has he seen you? Standing before the judgment throne of God. He saw you there. He saw you being judged according to your works. He saw the judge pronounce his righteous judgment. And the guilty, Jesus tells us, will be cast into outer darkness, where there'll be weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth. My friend, John saw you. What did he see? My friend, what's going to become of you when you stand before the judgment seat of God? What will he say to you? What will you say to him? Listen, my friends, when it comes to God's judgments, listen, there are no excuses, no exceptions, and no escape. You say, well, what am I going to do then? Run, man. Run! 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 Where? To Jesus Christ, the only Saviour of sinners. To Jesus Christ, who is presented to us in this great gospel that Paul is not ashamed of. To Jesus Christ, the Son of God, who came from heaven to save sinners. Run to Him who suffered on the cross to bear the punishment that we deserve. Go to Christ, my friend. Paul says, I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ. Why? For it's the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth. Do you believe? You must believe, my friend. You have no option. You have no alternative. Come to Jesus Christ and come this very night. My friends, eternity hangs on it. Come to Jesus Christ and be saved. Amen.